The truth is always out there, sometimes way out there, with the Midweek Drive team on Siren 107.3 FM.
Well, you say team, obviously, you know, there can be one, there can be duo, can be dynamic in all sorts of ways. It's always a delight to actually have Roger DeBank in the house, so to speak, Roger. So welcome to your good self, formally now, to the show.
And I formally accept your welcome.
Oh, it's fantastic. It's great stuff. You see, Cameron, that procedures and protocols are being observed here at the Midweek Drive, even though we have to say that Nicola Clancy will be on her way, I believe, arriving probably shortly after 6 o'clock, as fast as her little legs can take her from Newark to Lincoln. We really don't know what's happened to Hannah O'Brien these days. Since becoming Rookie of the Year, it's a question that even Phil Dearness might have challenges sorting out what's happening with respect to that. But nevertheless, it is time to say...
The best in contemporary country music, lashings of Americana, and taking digital worlds to new levels. It can only be Cameron Tilbury.
Quite right, too. And again, just a little heads up that as the show proceeds, we'll be speaking to writer Jenny Finch, who's just putting the finishing touches to the second in the Alex Hastings quadrilogy. The first one, of course, being Death of the Elver Man. Do you know what an Elver Man is, Cameron?
No, but if you hum a few bars, I might recognise the tune.
Now, clearly, Roger, you're aware of elving, presumably.
Absolutely. The Elver Man, elvers are young eels, and that's before they actually go down the rivers and end up in the Sargasso Sea and then come back to breed. And so a great delicacy in these parts.
And London, of course, where they're normally jellied, of course.
Absolutely.
So I gather.
That's just disgusting. It really is.
Well, you see, we like to feel that not only is there a great Olympiad happening in this country, Cameron, but we're also sharing that zone of jelly deals as well. And just make sure that Canadian ladies lose to the Team GB ladies next week. So, or Friday, in fact.
I'm not really cheering for Canada, so they can lose.
Well, there we are. Dana Cushing, our medieval scholar, who's based in Arizona, will be joining us as well in this hour. And then Michelle Monroe will be back with us with another classic. I can mention here, he has Celeste Yarnell and Nazim artist from Los Angeles and the author of The Odds Adam Parrott, but I won't. So there we are. Phil Lewis, of course, coming up as well. Cameron, you're going to be entrusted with the role of quizzing Roger, who's making his debut on the Midweek Drive. He's been on other shows at Siren, and certainly a number of the undergraduates, they remember Roger from the time when he greets them in Freshers Week, in Induction Week, with a friendly, warm welcome, saying, sort out the bibliography, sort it out now, and other such lines, etc. His planning for this year has already started in so many ways. But before we go to that, bipolar echo. Sounds like a bit of a psychological treatment, or a case for psychological treatment. I've had a look at the video. I've posted the video you actually shared with us. And these are classic rock guys, aren't they? With one important that we've got a girl at the lead singer. It's amazing.
Yeah, I actually came across these guys when I lived back in England a couple of years ago. They, Classic Rock magazine always puts out a CD with some top bands, and they were on it, and I heard one of their songs, and I thought, these guys really rock. I really like what they're doing. They're kind of in the vein of Lacuna Coil and 6 Hour Sundown, which is fronted by Lauren Harris, which is Steve Harris from Iron Maiden. That's his daughter. And I just thought they were a really great band, great sound. So I followed them ever since then, and on Facebook I talked with Kevin, their guitar player, quite often, and I just thought it's time to feature these guys because they really rock. They've got a new video out, and I think everybody's really going to like it. They're from Oklahoma. Ladies and gentlemen, please enjoy Bipolar Echo and Watch Me Fly.
Just watch me die.
Katie Grimason, Birmingham's Gift to the Galaxy, on the Midweek Drive for Siren FM and more.
She should appreciate that if she's listening. I don't know, whatever. She can let us know in certain ways. Cameron, you communicate with her via the internet sort of mediums, etc. Do you think she would have appreciated the fantastic world of Bipolar Echo?
Well, echo? I think so, because she just posted on Facebook that she was listening then, so I have funny feelings she liked it.
Hey. Well done,
and
Katie.
She did a little smiley face, too. Well,
yes. And it'll be played again tomorrow morning for the Midweek Drive Morning Edition. That's splendid stuff on that routine. OK, Cameron, it's over to you to don your interviewing mantle, the likes of which, of course, you used to do when you were broadcasting on Canada's premier station. Mind you, if it was called Canadia, it would be a whole interesting name.
It could have been, exactly.
Yeah, quite right too. Would you like to find out a little bit more about Roger DeBank, his life and times, how he's experiencing his first ever official midweek drive?
Well, I can just imagine that the thrill of sitting in that chair on midweek drive is overwhelming.
You have no idea, Cameron, how much I've had to pay for this. It cost me more than tickets to the 100 metres.
Well, see, the nice thing is when you want to do something prestige like do the midweek drive, you can buy your ticket to do that, but you don't have to buy a ticket for some lame event that nobody else wants to listen to.
That's right, exactly.
So, what exactly, tell everybody what exactly you do.
Righty-ho. Well, what I do is a level tutor. I'll go from the start. I'm a former evening newspaper assistant editor, news editor. I've been a consultant for a news group, etc., etc. And then I came into the world of academia. And one of my main job as level one tutor is to look after the level one students when they arrive here. They're coming here, and whatever or any of them say, it's a frightening experience. You're leaving home for the first time. They're looking forward to it, most of them, or virtually all of them. But it is a pretty big step. And really, my initial job is to make them comfortable, to make them know where things are, explain about the course in greater detail. In the welcome week, we have things such as quiz nights and things like this as well, because the main thing that I want them to do in that first week or the first 2 weeks is make friends. It's vital while they're here that they have friends. They have that support medium, as well as the medium of the things that we can provide as well. The student services can provide the housing and all the rest of it. But we want
the pub night. That's always a good one.
Sorry.
Tickets for pub night, that's always a good one.
That's right, yes, and we've got a and on the campus, of course, we've got a thing called the engine shed, which is great, and it's got a huge hall, and we get some top acts in there, and that is an important side of it. But we don't ever forget, in those first 2 or 3 weeks as well, is that what we want them to understand is that when they come into a university, that we want them, and particularly if they're coming into something like journalism or somewhere where they've got a definite aim at the end of this, is that they need to start developing professionalism, and they need to actually, there is a really serious side to their studies. So that we want them to get that kind of life balance.
I remember when, I mean, I still have friends now, this is, 30 years after the fact almost, that I made during Frosh Week.
Oh, please don't get emotional, Cameron, we can't cope with this at this stage.
No, these people, there's nothing to be emotional about.
Acquaintances, that's what we say, acquaintances, yeah, that's the key thing. Don't worry, coming up in the show later we'll have Lee Marvin and Wandering Star. I'm not kidding.
Great.
It's a classic in its own routine from that point of view. Now, Roger, the other thing, I think you were caught on a little bit on the hop, because you obviously saw, country music, fantastic.
Yeah.
And then, of course, you get Bipolar Echo, which is part of the new wave of country music, because you're old school country music. I mean, the country music that really Cameron might turn around and say, well, that's interesting, such as?
Well, such as, I think that my favourite song of all time has to be El Paso with Marty Robbins. I think it's absolutely fabulous, and I suppose as a journalist as well, when you get the love that is stronger than death and all this kind of stuff that goes into these songs, I like the rhythm of them, and I really, clever words that happen in them. I mean, other things, Ring of Fire, Johnny Cash. Great stuff again. I mean, I don't know a huge amount about about country western per se, but Tammy Wynette.
Don't mention western, please. It's country music.
That's country music.
The western went a wee while ago.
Well,
got no street cred, Roger. If you actually go into a country house and you turn around and say, "Where is the country and western here?" Oh, you've been silenced.
I have no musical street cred. To start with, but look, Loretta Lynn and these kind of people. It's all of that sort of stuff that I had when I was kind of growing up. When I was, I've always liked to listen to up-to-date music. For instance, I've been listening to Lady Gaga and things like that again. Well, yeah, but I mean,
well-known country act, of course.
A well-known country act, in her case, some great words in the things.
Well, of course,
that's what I want messages when these things are being performed.
Messages, Cameron. That's what we want. Messages, not orchestral manoeuvres in the dark or OMD. Just messages. There are one or two 80s people who might get that allusion. Yeah. Many people would just say, "Whoa."
There's one thing I do like is somebody being abusive as well. It's because it makes
there we could have actually got some rap artists in for you, Roger. Sorry, we could give you lots of abuse on that basis.
Eminem is
fine. We would have been taken off there, but never mind.
I'm there.
There we are. Cameron, have you had a reasonably interesting telephonic link with us in this start of the show?
I always do. Yes, I have.
Now, next week, do you mind coming in at around about 5:20 as opposed to the normal 5 o'clock? Because we're going live to the fabulous Gene, Bruce Scott and Randy Reinholtz from Los Angeles with Native American Voices. With the great news, yes, I will reveal it now, they will be in Britain next April, hopefully coming up to the university as well. They're certainly going to be based in Grantham, doing a variety of things there from that point of view. So not giving too much away, both Gene, Bruce Scott. She was, of course, the classic Caitlin O'Shaughnessy in the series Airwolf, and was in Magnum PI, amongst other things.
Absolutely.
Tom Selleck.
They're coming.
So I get bumped because of Gene Bruce Scott.
No, we're just moving you away. If you want the real reason, Randy has to be ferried by Gene to an appointment later on. So we thought, we'd ask Cameron nicely if he'd be up for that, and I'm sure he'd be sweet.
You told me Cameron was a gentleman anyway, didn't you?
Always Canadian, inevitably. It's part of the course, I guess.
I'm absolutely fine with that. Just tell Jean that I was glad to do it for her to accommodate her schedule.
I will make sure that message gets duly put across because, sometimes juggling these things around is a whole range of scenarios that we're faced with. So I take it then you've answered the second question. You will return.
I will. One more time. Celebrate and dance so free. One more time. I have the feeling so free. We're gonna celebrate and dance so free. One more time. You just have the feeling so free. We're gonna celebrate and dance.
French, I believe. Daft Punk. One more time.
Hi, I'm Trevor Dan, or Professor Trevor Dan, as they like to call me at the University of Lincoln. You are listening to Siren FM.
Thank you very much. You just have the feeling so free. We're gonna. And I think they've gone now. Okay, we're looking for soundtracks. We could be looking for soundtracks because the next young lady, I have to say, is just heading into a whole new perfect career as an author extraordinaire and did provide me with a special sneak peek to Volume 2 in the Alex Hastings quadrilogy. Clearly, I am sworn to total silence and cannot say anything in any way, shape or form apart from the fact that if you enjoyed Death of the Elver Man, you will be blown away by the second in the quadrilogy, and that's just on the basis of seeing a little sneak peek. So we naturally say, author of Death of the Elver Man, Jenny Finch. Are you indeed there, Jenny?
I am indeed, and thank you for the young.
Well, it's true. Only young people are based in Saltburn by the Sea. That's what I've frequently said, really. It's a constant line of the whole system, basically. When last we spoke, of course, it was the Midweek Drive morning edition, so we've shifted on to the afternoon setups here. I think you were in France as well, just putting the finishing touches to the second in the quadrilogy. It's a foursome, in case people are wondering. Why does he keep talking about quadrilogy? Is it like trilogy? Yes, it's one more than a trilogy, etc. Or quartet, you could actually say.
Quartet.
All right, then. 9 years. Well, yes.
Easier to spell.
Yeah, very true. Exactly. And it's not a string quartet. You're putting the finishing touches to it in France. Presumably, you've already got ideas for number 3 and number 4 as well.
I have. There were originally going to be 4 books in total, 3 down in Somerset and 1 based up here in Saltburn. In fact, now there are going to be four in Somerset.
Ooh.
And one up here. At least one up here.
It's a quintet. Fantastic.
Well, it's a quartet and a few add-ons.
Oh, that's very good. That's okay. You'll be pleased to know that Roger DeBank, for it is he who is our co-presenter today, was delighted when I actually raised the issue of Elverman and social work and various other things. Why, Roger? Why was that? When I passed the book over to your good self, he said, oh, this is exciting.
Well, I just think that I've got family out in the Fens in Lincolnshire, and the Somerset Levels and the Lincolnshire flatlands around here have got so much in common. And it's such a rich area for characters and backdrops as well, but both of them. I've been through the Somerset Levels on many occasions and dwelled there rather than carried on into Gloucestershire and all sorts of other places, because it's got a magical feeling about it.
And indeed, to go back to the precy of Death of the Elverman, probation officer Alex Hastings is struggling with the customs dialect and prejudice she faces as an incomer to the Somerset Levels when one of her probationers, Kevin Mallory, is charged with murdering the Elverman who operated in the poaching underworld. She is embroiled in the investigation. Determined to prove Mallory is innocent, Alex puts her own career at risk as she searches for the truth behind the Elverman's death, but her efforts attract the attention of the real killer. Alex finds herself drawn into a web of family feuds, gang loyalties, and revenge killings as an unknown predator stalks her across the eerie landscape of the Levels. I'm already thinking Midsummer Murders, eat your heart out.
Yes, that's right.
Quite literally. Yes, and indeed was proven by reading through the book, which I've actually promised, Jenny, that I'm going to pass on my own copy of Death of the Elverman. I can't pass on the copy that I'm holding at present because it belongs to Middlesbrough Libraries and Information Services, thanks to Jill Appleton, marvellous stuff. But I have actually gone and purchased online my own copy for this. That's praise indeed, Roger.
Thank you very much.
Well, exactly. I've been told it's arriving. It depends in terms of how soon the company actually manages to deliver it, because, of course, that can always be a challenge, really. It's the waiting. Yeah. It's the anticipation.
Yeah.
How did the Middlesbrough Literary Festival go? Because clearly when we last spoke, that was one of the other things we were talking about. Were you duly praised and acknowledged as the genius that you are, Jenny?
It was a really nice evening. I shared the evening with two other local crime writers, Daniel Ramsey and Valerie Lord. And we had a good time. We had some good readings and remarkably intelligent and perceptive and exciting questions. It was a thoroughly lovely evening.
This is one of the things which I've noticed in the early part of the 21st century has become not quite a phenomenon, but an essential part of the whole literary scene. Now, I appreciate that you can say, well, Charles Dickens used to do it. He used to go out on tours and do readings from his various books. It's nothing new. It's happened before. But it seemed for a long time there was a bit of a gap before you'd actually get that magic between the writer, the creator of the manuscripts and the scripts, actually meeting the authors. And it's something which I think it's gradually becoming, not just with the big festivals, the Hay on Wyse and the various Edinburgh festivals and so on, but also for the more rural growing festivals. It's becoming quite a nice way of actually ensuring that the connection between audience, author and text can actually really sort of come alive.
I think it's really important and it's a wonderful development. It's become, I try and view it as a part of my job. Writing the book, that's the easy part of the job. The harder bit comes afterwards with the marketing, with the readings, with meeting people, with interviews, if you're lucky enough to get those, and I have been this time. And I think they're vitally important because it helps you to reach out to an audience. It helps you to feel what the audience felt about the book, and everybody has an opinion or a question. Sometimes you think, yes, they're right, and sometimes you think, well, no, I don't agree with that, but at least I know why they've said it, and it gives me a much better feel of for whom I'm writing. And I think everybody has to write for somebody else, otherwise you get hopelessly self-indulgent. And to know that there are people out there who actually have the people I invented in my head and talk about them as if they're real people is very good. It helps to firm my character up. And people come along and go, well, what about so-and-so? Why didn't you say more about them? And if enough people say it, I think, well, I think Iris or Simon should step forward next time round, because people want to know about them.
We want Ada. We want Ada. We want
Ada. Now, I will give you a small exclusive. I'm exploring the possibility of writing some shorter standalone novellas between 10 and 20,000 words that in a lot of ways fill in the backstory, because otherwise this is one reason I think books get huge, because the characters become so big and complex. Mm. So the first one I want to write, and you're not the only one who's requested this, is a short book about Ada and how she met Frank Mallory and how she got to where she is now.
Like it, you know.
Kindle only.
Well, exactly. Questions from your good self, Roger. Anything you'd like to put to Jenny about writing her own particular life journey? Anything, really. She's a very amenable soul.
Well, I'm really interested in how an author actually forms those characters. I mean, you go along, do you, people that you meet, you dip in there and you find a particular trait that you find attractive, or you find... Well, how do you actually do that?
Actually, all of the characters, particularly around the probation area, and to a certain extent, a lot of the probationers, yes, are a mix of four or five people, different traits that are useful,
yes,
for the story. I think one is actually recognisable as a real person, and she's thrilled with her character.
Yes.
But the others are all mixtures. Yeah. When I came to writing the real villain of Elver Man, Derek Johns, having studied psychology up to master's level, I found that I could write, hopefully, a believable real villain with proper motives without actually having to meet one. Although I have, in the past, working in hostels, encountered a real genuine psychopath. And when you meet the real thing, you know it.
Yes.
It's terrifying.
Yes. Yeah, I think that's the thing. I think that's the kind of the essential difference between a journalist and an author, where we go along and we write the story or we describe the scene or whatever, but you really have to get under the skin of all of the characters within the book and actually bring them out through your writing. And I think that's an incredible skill to have.
Thank you. I think you have to care about your characters.
Yes.
But as a friend of mine said, if you have a choice between making friends with a vulture or a writer, choose the vulture, because at least the vulture will wait until you're dead before it eats the juicy bits and takes your heart.
Oh, right, yeah.
something we can share with our English colleagues, I feel, in many ways, really, well, for the creative writing courses here,
yes,
at the University of Lincoln.
I will allow you to say that.
Thank you very much. You see, obviously crossing over to humanities from that
absolutely
perspective.
Absolutely, yes, exactly. Right.
We'll work our way through that. I always thought it was psychologists one had to be aware of, because they were always psychoanalysing yourself. Never mind.
No.
Listening skills are vital and crucial.
Yes.
Jenny, I'm going to ask you to do a little random thing, not from your own book this time, but from an author who's joining us in the second part of the programme, that's Adam Parrott, in the same line as you were, actually, in many ways, except he's a young adult writer, a young children's author. Would you like to give me a number between 1 and 110, please?
Ooh, 73.
73, OK, this is the tale of the odds. Just before the car roared away, Mrs. Plopwell waved the blueprints at Mr. Plopwell and said, "Remind me, darling, what's the name of that dreadful little street we're bulldozing to make way for our mega supermarket?" Mr. Plopwell grinned as he pulled down his flying goggles. "I think it's called Rotten Row, dear. Yes, that's it. Rotten Row. Dirty, horrid little street it is. I dare say Trot will be a finer place without it. Tally-ho!" And they zoomed off down the hill, leaving a shocked and sore-headed Mr. Odd staring after them, wearing a dustbin lid for a hat. Just a little sneak preview there. Adam Parrott, and again, the question is, have you ever fallen flat on your face when you're carrying an ice cream, or put down a drink, gone back to get it, and it's nowhere to be seen? That's the odds at work. So a bit of cross-referencing from that point of view. Of course, in the words of mashup literature, the notion of Alex Hastings meeting in with the odds, it's a thought, you know.
Yes.
If you can have Mickey Mouse connecting with Kevin, I mean, there's all sorts of things there, anyway. I will speak to Adam in the second part of the programme. Jenny, any sort of thoughts or questions in terms of us? Obviously, we're not going to give anything away, because it would spoil it, and it would, you know, Mr. Diva doesn't like to give his sneak previews away from that line of things, etc. So we work on that basis. But as you're sort of developing the Alex Hastings story, will you be looking to kind of, further enhance the thing? I mean, really what I'm edging to is the real reason she's actually called Alex, because it's not Alex, really. You know, will there be other revelations, other shocking revelations that we'll be finding out?
Yes, Alex has secrets, and it's becoming increasingly difficult to keep those secrets. And one of my readers said, where's her edge? Ada's got an edge, Kevin's got an edge, where's Alex's edge? And I said, Alex's edge is very deeply hidden, but it's there, and it comes out through the four books.
Bono had an edge, he was the guitarist, sorry. Couldn't resist it. It's a U2 joke, I appreciate it. Some people might know you.
I think I'd just like to share with you why he's offered me the book. In the Siren studio, out in the outer studio, I was sat there and Alex came in to do whatever
Alex
does.
Just check he was still functioning, all those bits and pieces.
He was, because they've had an upgrade and he was hitting things with hammers and waiting to hear them ring properly and stuff.
Right.
He was doing all those kind of things. And he'd left the book there and I thought Somerset Levels, that's interesting because, I could picture the scene of that straight away. And he said, Roger, would you like to come in now? Oh, I see. And I was gone.
Totally focused. I was just on the opening few chapters.
First few pages. He said, I'll get my copy. You can't have this one. When you get my copy, you can have it.
And obviously borrow it, not have it. I mean, obviously. I need to get it.
He did actually say borrow, but I thought I nearly got away with that. I think I will have to go and buy one, Alex. I couldn't deprive you.
Well, there we are.
Thank you very much indeed.
Jenny, have you had a reasonably interesting return to the Midweek Drive?
I have enjoyed my return enormously, Alex.
So can we look forward to connecting with you again in the not-too-distant future? And who knows, maybe featuring you in the studio, either north or south in the near future as well.
I would like that enormously as well.
Excellent, Jenny Finch. Writer extraordinaire, we salute you.
Thank you.
Sneak preview, a gentleman who will be on the show tomorrow morning at 8:40 a.m. That's UK time. That's Peter Kerr, of course, a writer himself these days, as well as producer and a whole range of things. That's Caraval from Peter Kerr. Now, all things medieval, clearly a classic scenario coming across in every sense of the way. And when you actually have an academic career which takes you through Canada, Britain and the United States, you study under Edward A. Sinan, you gain an in-depth knowledge of medieval religion and culture, especially relating to the Crusades, and you serve in the US Marine Corps, clearly you are one special person, and accordingly, it's a delight when we keep the Canadian theme going on the show, because obviously we had Cameron Tilbury earlier from Nashville, a Canadian now based in Nashville. Now we have a Canadian now based in Arizona. We say the fabulous Dana Cushing. Are you indeed there, Dana?
Yes, I am. Thank you, Alex.
Good to connect with your good self, and thanks also to Fiona Moore, our mutual colleague from Royal Holloway College in London, who, when we were talking about interesting links, because I think it was a link that you made on her Facebook page, I thought, this is quite interesting. Who's this sort of person? She said, Dana Cushing does a whole range of things from that perspective. And here you are. So first question, Dana, why medievalism? What is this fascination with 1,000 years ago?
Well, that's an excellent question, Alex, and I should begin by answering that our mutual friend Fiona Moore is actually one of the people who got me interested in medieval history. I had been interested in military history generally. My mother was an archivist, and we had the opportunity in Ontario to travel around a number of different pioneer and military and archaeology sites. So originally my interest was military history and Canadian history, but when we were in the ninth grade, so about 13 or 14 years old, Fiona and some other friends of ours had found the Society for Creative Anachronism, which specializes in reenacting medieval events, or I should say the Middle Ages as it would have been if it were not having plagues and things like that. So I went to an event with her, and that was really what got me started on it. I was pretty much hooked from that event, and I bounced around a few different eras of medieval history, because you're correct, there is So much of it, 1,000 years between roughly 600 and 1600 AD, depending what part of Europe you're in. And that was really the beginning, and it's been almost 20 years now.
I was particularly fascinated in reading some of your papers that are available online to come across your concept of harbour hopping and the Crusaders pursuing their strategy of harbour hopping down the Atlantic coast, in which they took Oporto, Lisbon, Silves and Cadiz. It seems as though that whole interesting scenario of strategic places, people are desperately seeking to enhance their political power and prestige and so on, with respect to trade and maritime explorers. Most of us, I think, tend to think, oh, well, it all started with Henry VIII, but it was taking place long before that.
It was, and actually I'm glad you mentioned that. England especially, Frisia and northern Germany and the Low Countries as well, but England was well ahead of other countries in terms of its maritime logistics. And I've, in studying the harbor hopping, I found out that it actually began back even in the decline of the Roman Empire. The old routes were kept up. They became disused or forgotten or contested by different powers over time. But that connection between northern Europe and the Mediterranean never really ceased. And the Crusades were an opportunity actually for those routes to be revitalized and to be contested once more, this time not just between northerners and southerners, but also Christians and Muslims as well.
There are many folk who would actually say it's Sun Tzu, the art of war. That's what you need to do to actually appreciate and get on in life, and a whole variety of other factors as well. But from the areas that you've touched on so far, and again this notion of realism and pragmatism, etc., do you tend to think that we still are engaging in the Crusades? I mean, a lot of theoreticians have been saying, well, one of the challenges we actually face, and which resulted in 9/11, which resulted in the kind of misunderstandings between our brothers and sisters on the planet who happen to live in the Middle East at present, is that they're still having their form of medievalism. So therefore, by studying our own medieval history, we can come to a better understanding of the way forward. Do you buy into that concept, or is it a case of, you know, that's a bit too simplistic, really?
No, I'm afraid I don't buy into that. I understand very well where it comes from, but I'm afraid I personally don't buy into that. The difficulty is it's a tempting theory because groups like Al-Qaeda, as we know, in the Middle East, have the name the Alliance of Muslims for Fighting the Jews and Crusaders. That's what their name, full name, literally translates to. And so that would indicate that they, at least, are still fighting the Crusades. But I think the Crusades, as they actually happened, were really more of an economic phenomenon, more of a frontier almost phenomenon, as Europe sort of emerged from that darker period before the what's called the 12th century Renaissance, which actually began in slightly confusingly in the late 11th century, so 1095 for the Crusades, but carried forward through the 12th century. And it's interesting that once you get past the 12th century into the 13th, and you get to the Fourth Crusade and the sack of Constantinople and things, that's where you really find out what the Crusades pretty much were about, because they start focusing on sacking specific cities like Constantinople, or trying to move populations of people out of Europe, like with the Children's Crusade. And so I think that the Crusades really were not religion was certainly part of it, and it was certainly a motivator for some people, but I think it's partly to do with sort of the awakening to the rest of the world and wanting to explore the rest of the world, and of course once you get there and find it has wonderful resources to control that.
Well, there is of course that, which comes across time and time again. A couple of more questions from my end before I pass over to Roger DeBank, who I'm sure has got lots of fascinating inquiries to make. We're approaching the millennium celebration of the Magna Carta, obviously, in 1215, which was sort of like 2015. Things were coming across from that point of view. We also hear a great deal about the Dark Ages and various other factors. Do you feel that the Magna Carta, A, is as significant a piece of documentation as it's often portrayed, certainly to us. I mean, clearly, the University of Lincoln, we're very proud that in the city of Lincoln, we actually have a copy of the Magna Carta. We celebrate that fact, etc. But I've been hearing recently about the fact that, you know, the Magna Carta, which really served as the basis and the bedrock for the American Declaration of Independence, amongst other things, it's in danger of almost kind of losing its way as we head into the 21st century and people neglecting to acknowledge its importance.
That's a very interesting question, and I'm afraid I'm not as good an expert of legal history as I might be, but speaking as someone who has since become an American and from my studies of the American Constitution and its basis in the Magna Carta, I believe that the Magna Carta is very significant because it is that first step. It's that first document, that first concrete evidence that we have of how people came out of the 12th century Renaissance thinking about themselves, thinking about their government. And I think in about 800 years later, that we are a bit in danger of losing some of those things. People tend to want to give up a lot of their rights and freedoms in exchange for security, and that's very troubling.
Roger.
I think the thing that fascinates me about the Crusades, well, if I just sort of wind back a little bit, we know the Second World War, 40 million plus people died, the most horrific bloodbath that there has ever been. I think, you know, with the passage of time, the Crusades have taken on this superficially, you know, for people like me who's taught it at school and the programs.
King Richard.
Robin
Hood.
Well, you've got. Well, there is that. There is the other things such as the relationship between King Richard and the King of France. There's also the things Saladin sending grapes or a horse to Richard and all these kind of things that go into the folklore. Just how injurious was this set of battles or this set of campaigns to the progress of the Western world?
Well, it depends on how you're going to measure progress. Economically, it was terribly detrimental to England. You know, Richard's quite famous for offering to sell London to the highest bidder. Mm. And certainly the English treasury suffered enormously for it. But on the other hand, you have to look at the things that were brought back in terms of the different kinds of knowledge and the trade goods, and so it really is a balancing act. It depends how you're going to define progress. I think it's time, and this tends to get glossed over because King Richard is rather one of the more popular English kings, especially considering his younger brother definitely wasn't.
Yes.
I think people were willing to forgive him rather a lot more than they would have perhaps someone who wasn't quite so popular in the imagination. But any military undertaking, such as a crusade or a modern war, is going to sock it to your treasury, to put it bluntly.
Yes.
I really do think that, you know, as much as Richard spent in coin, other things came back. But that's one of the interesting things about the Third Crusade, is it's hardly been studied, so it's very difficult to evaluate what specifically were the returns. And that's one of the things I've been attempting to do through the logistics, is to find out what exactly was spent, how exactly that was accomplished. Certainly there were leaps forward in, unfortunately, bureaucracy in England, thanks to the Third Crusade. But in terms of goods coming back, that's some work that remains to be done.
Yeah, I think it's fascinating. I mean, I did actually, because you were coming on, actually do a little bit of research, you know, because I'm interested in any kind of history. I love places like Malta, Portugal, because of all those things. Is that when the siege of Accra was on, there were an estimated 600,000 men engaged in it. And I never kind of got the scale, you know, of this, of some of these kind of battles.
That's six times as many people can fit into Wembley Stadium.
Absolutely.
Astounding.
Right, and that's another thing that I look at, especially after my experience working with the military in Africa. We used to have a rule there that if somebody told us something about the enemy, we would divide the number by 10 or four, depending how much we trusted that person. And there is a bit of sensationalism in the medieval reporting. Unfortunately, a lot of the surviving sources were chronicled by monks and others who were not necessarily there. The particular manuscript that I'm working on, which is called De Itinere Navali, and it was written by the anonymous German. We believe he may have been a cleric or of the constable class, which is an upper sort of urban class that's unique to northern Germany at that time. That is someone who might be a bit more reliable, and his numbers do in fact coincide with some archaeological findings. But as for other battles where you've mentioned that, you know, it's a 60,000, or I think some crusade early sources talking about the siege of Jerusalem talk about 100 to 300,000, depending who you're reading. That's another one of the questions that really needs attention and needs to get sorted out so we can get at the truth.
Well, I think
propaganda in the media hasn't gone away.
That's exactly what I was thinking. When you get a situation, I think it's fascinating that you're looking at the logistics, because really effectively where you know how much it takes to feed an army or whatever, and then you start looking at the hard facts of that, it gives you a much better idea of what's actually going on. Amazing.
Right. And that's one of the key issues. John Lynn actually began studying that back in the early 90s. There's a famous essay that he wrote, which is in a book by Bernard Bacharach, called Feeding Mars. And I came across that as an undergraduate, and that's actually how I became interested in studying logistics, because this entire book is basically trying to figure out, you know, how are we feeding these people? What kind of supplies would that take? Is that possible, considering
perhaps it was
the
like the feeding of the 5,000? Perhaps it was a miracle. I don't know. Maybe it's a different line of time. Perhaps there's a religious illusion there.
That's a bit before my time, I'm afraid.
Indeed. We always sort of work through that. Dana, it's been an absolute joy to connect with you. I have to read out a little Facebook comment we had from Diane Gonzalez, who actually sort of wanted to know, what time should a Phoenix person tune in to hear you? Well, you can always listen again on southsidebroadcasting.podbean.com, which you might already be doing. But it's nice to see that we have a hidden treasure here, and I think I would endorse that, Diane's views with respect to yourself. Of course, the line D.D. Cushing on that basis. Thoroughly enjoyed this little flavour, little small aperitif of medievalism. And again, Antimony Media, go-to place to sort out all manner of details. So we've got to ask you two final questions. It's part of the form,
sure.
Dana. First of all, have you had a reasonably interesting telephonic debut on the Midweek Drive today?
Yes, and I very much appreciate the opportunity. Medievalists tend to get stuck behind large stacks of books in libraries, so it's lovely to get out and be able to speak with your listeners.
Well, I think we're going to actually smash right through those stacks of bookshelves, etc., by saying, can we look forward to connecting with you again in the very near future?
Oh, please do. I'd love to.
There we are, Dana Cushing, medieval scholar extraordinaire based in Arizona. We've got a whole heap of other scenarios I'm sure we can actually talk to. We salute you, and we'll see you again very soon.
Thank you very much, Alex.
I'm going back to...